Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the debate in the United States over what efforts should be or could be implemented to lower CO2 emissions continues unabated, what's become more and more evident is that departments of the federal government, local communities, businesses, and non-governmental organizations are planning and spending more and more time and money to mitigate a global temperature increase's effects and consequences. My guest today is a leading specialist on the political dimensions of climate change. Dr. Joshua Busby is an associate professor of public affairs and a distinguished scholar at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas. He recently also joined the Center for Climate and Security as a senior research fellow. He's the author of two books, Moral Movements and Foreign Policy and AIDS Drugs for All, Social Movements and Market Transformations. He's also the author of several studies on climate change, national security, and energy policy from the Council on Foreign Relations, the Brookings Institution, the German Marshall Fund, and the Center for a New American Security. In fact, he's one of the lead researchers on two major grants looking at climate change and African political stability, and another on the political stability in Asia. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and I spoke with him while he was here. Joshua Busby, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Scientists have long been warning that a global temperature increase of 2 degrees Celsius would be the tipping point for devastating effects of climate change. This last fall, the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change now believes we'll reach 1.5 degrees rise in Celsius by 2030. That's a little over a decade away. How serious do you think world governments are taking that estimate that we're three-fourths of the way to the tipping point?
I don't think governments around the world are taking the issue seriously enough. Whether or not we reach 1.5 degrees increase over pre-industrial levels by 2030 or 2034, it's a little unclear. But we're already more than 1 degree Celsius above what we were before the dawn of the industrial age. And so we've already started to notice it in all sorts of different weird weather patterns. And so given what's needed to stave off dangerous climate change, it's pretty clear that world leaders aren't taking it seriously enough. Some more than others, but collectively, we're not on track to deal with this. Now, I would dispute that, you know, 2 degrees isn't if we don't meet the 2 degree threshold, all is not lost. But so giving up is not an option. But we're certainly not on track to contain global temperature increases below 2 degrees. Could be on track by the end of the century to be, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 degrees, and that would truly be calamitous.
Do you think that lack of seriousness by governments is a result of just the political will of the people in their government, within their countries, not clamoring for serious change, the actual popular will to change?
Partially,
it's not there.
This is just a really difficult problem. The military sometimes talks about wicked problems. This is certainly one of those, in that it's not something that any one country can resolve on its own. So you need to wangle 190 countries in the world to come together to reach an agreement on how to proceed for technologies that produce these emissions are central to how we move ourselves around and heat and light our homes. And so we've now got some pretty good alternatives to some of those fossil fuel-based resources. But you're kind of turning the global economy away from what we've become accustomed to for 100 years isn't easy. And so that means that got infrastructure and interests all aligned to support how we've been doing things for 100 years. So it's certainly not easy. And I think that's part of the reason. The other thing is that most of the changes until recently were seen as distant, and the major beneficiaries were going to be our kids and grandkids who don't have a vote in the present day. There's just a whole host of reasons why this is a really tough problem. And you know, people have sort of short-term needs that they're worried about, not just economic needs, but there are more pressing environmental concerns that people often think about first. I was recently in Delhi in India, and the air quality there is unbelievable, orders of magnitude higher than what the World Health Organization recommends for like healthy life. For them, the more pressing environmental concerns are probably related to air pollution, and climate change is a more distant threat. So that plus all these other reasons makes this a really tricky problem for us to generate attention for and political will in favor of addressing it.
And yet Delhi has had some serious effects of climate change. They've had several heat waves in the last decade where you're looking at incredible temperatures.
Certainly India, all over the country, has experienced incredible heat waves. And you've had, if not in Delhi and other cities, thousands of people have died in places that are accustomed to pretty high temperatures. And so, but they don't yet in many places have the kinds of infrastructure luxuries that we have, like air conditioning. But as they get richer, they're going to ask for it. And in the absence of new technologies that make them more energy efficient and rely on less polluting technology, India's future emissions growth is really alarming.
One of the things you discussed in a recent article for Foreign Policy Magazine was something called global weirding, which is basically weird weather, which is one of the topics you're going to be talking about for the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, and how. The link is tenuous between any weather event and climate change and global warming, but what are some of the things that climate scientists are talking about as these global weirding events?
Well, I got that terminology from a Texas Tech climatologist, Catherine Hayhoe, who's prominent scientists on this issue. I myself am a political scientist, so
right.
I try and draw inferences from what scientists say to the political and governmental realm. But we've had instances in which, you know, the seasonality, when we're expecting rain, we don't get it. And then when it does rain, it all falls all at once. So you had unprecedented rainfall events like we saw in Houston with 40 inches of, or 50 inches of rain falling in a handful of days. Those kinds of extremes are an extreme weather events. Scientists in the past were very cautious about attributing any single event to climate change, but there's a whole field of what they call attribution studies, which they're increasingly able to say, because of these parameters of climate change, we're able to say that they're making this storm, you know, X percent more likely. And so those changes in seasonality, the extremes that are unlike anything we've ever seen before. 16 of the 17 hottest years on record since modern record keeping began have occurred since 2000. And so, you know, and then there are all a whole host of other unprecedented kinds of changes. You've seen the hot oceans killing off a third to a half of the Great Barrier Reef of the coral reefs in Australia. Those kinds of things, you know, didn't used to happen. And so we're having to understand and deal with the consequences. Nature doesn't care what your partisanship is. It's just going to do its thing. And we've got to adapt and prepare for it and change our behavior to make sure that it doesn't get any worse than it's already gotten.
And I think a lot of effort around the world is going into adapting rather than trying to eliminate CO2. I mean, some of the countries that perhaps where you would say are growing their CO2 emissions or have been, they're basically coming up with adaptation strategies.
Well, it's a both and situation. Uh-huh. We can't merely adapt our way out of this problem, but we have to prepare for it. Some amount of climate change is already inevitable. We're seeing it already. And so whether it be in agriculture or coastal preparedness, there are just a whole series of changes to protect our infrastructure, including our military bases, many of which, when you think about Norfolk Naval Base with rising sea levels, they just as a matter of doing business is pure prudence. They've got to make sure that they can continue to protect the country. And so whether it be this country or others, All countries around the world are facing different degrees of climate effects, and adaptation is part of that strategy. But as I said, if we just throw in the towel and try and adapt our way out of this problem, and global temperature averages increase by 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, it's game over. That's the cost of that would probably be much too expensive for us to even deal with.
Now, speaking of cost, a lot of people will look at these anomalous events like outside of a hurricane,
right.
50 inches falling in a rain falling, just a weird storm pattern, which right. drops tremendous amounts of rain, causes flash flooding.
Right.
Do we have a cost of what these weird weather events are costing the economy, and what it's costing, effect on GDP for individual nations?
Well, it's a little unclear if it has a net drag effect on GDP. Sometimes the recovery itself.
The recovery, yes. Spurs growth.
But
yeah.
The cost of the storms in 2017 were on the order of when you had Maria and Rita and Harvey were $300 billion. That's $300 billion we could have spent on something else. $300 billion we could have spent on shoring up infrastructure. 3,000 people died in Puerto Rico. Now, not directly as a result of exposure to the storm, but in the aftermath of inability to get access to medication, power outages for months and months on end, that kind of stuff. It was unnecessary if we had adequate preparation. Now, if a storm hits and there's an effective government response, there are going to be some losses inevitable. And storms have happened for time immemorial, but there's a certain constellation of high ocean temperatures and other factors that scientists increasingly are able to say, these storms are different than before in their severity.
One of the big issues that when climate change was really talked about, say in the 90s and 2000s, it was about island nations in the Southwest Pacific, where maybe they're only a couple meters high at their highest point, that they would, rising sea level would inundate those. But really, you write in your article, that makes headlines, but what was probably a little more insidious is the average storm that hits, say, the southeast coast here in the United States, the deltas in Southeast Asia, or along the southwest side, southeast side of China, or in the Indus Valley, or these are huge agricultural producing areas, and the storm surge is a saltwater incursion. The water comes, it goes away, but the land is not productive because it's been sown with salt.
Yeah, the worries about saltwater intrusion's effect on agriculture are such that, before some of these low-lying island nations become uninhabitable due to storms, they may not be productive for agriculture or have adequate drinking water, so places will have to be abandoned. That may be true for those low-lying island nations, but that's also true for coastal areas in densely populated parts of the world like Bangladesh. And so, what do those people do? Where will they move? And those are questions we've scarcely begun to contemplate. Now, human beings are an amazingly industrious species. We can maybe come up with salt-tolerant species or varietals of rice or what have you, but kind of get on our horse and start to prepare for these problems and get our finest minds to focus on the solutions to them and preventing the consequences from happening in the first place to the extent we can. And we haven't really done that.
No. Another aspect of global weirding, if you will, has been drought, not following your traditional patterns. I mean, certain places can be prone to periodic drought. Mm-hmm. And the weird instances like here in the United States where along the West Coast, there was a traditional fire season. Mm. Now there's two traditional. There are now two new fire seasons. A fire season in the spring, even well before summer and the traditional fall period.
Yeah, the folks on the West Coast may have to have fire services prepared to work year round, unlike seasonal preparedness, and that's in part hastened by these changes that we're observing, changes in seasons, that when we do have droughts, they last longer, they're far more severe than they were before. If you have decreased snowpack, the kinds of snowmelt and other kinds of water resources downstream, I think the Colorado River is, in part, it's a function of increased demand, but there are places throughout the United States that we wonder if the kind of migration to the West with retiree populations, is that going to be sustainable over time with changes in rainfall? I'm not so sure.
My guest today is Joshua Busby. He's an associate professor of public affairs and a distinguished scholar at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law, the University of Texas. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking on the climate change imperative, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let me ask you about, as a political scientist, the effects of this weird weather. What are the things you're looking at as far as how this affects political relations between countries and regions?
I've done a couple of projects for the Department of Defense. They have a social science initiative called the Minerva Initiative, and we looked at identifying hotspots of what we call climate security vulnerability in Africa and Southeast Asia. And among the things that we're worried about is rising political instability from the effects of climate change, from increased climate-related natural disasters, increased demand for humanitarian emergencies, but it could have knock-on effects in terms of conflict. Now, those relationships are quite a bit more complex, but it is true that the immediate aftermath of cyclones, like we saw here in the U.S. with the hurricane season, often requires military mobilization to rescue people, and that can be considerably expensive. And so those kinds of effects of climate-related disasters on human well-being can become security problems in their own right, requiring militaries to help people from dying. That also happens in relation to droughts. We saw that in the Horn of Africa in recent years, where really extensive droughts led to more than 250,000 people dying in Somalia in 2011. And so those are the kinds of things that people like me are worried about when we're interested in understanding the effects of climate change overseas. We're worried about those humanitarian emergencies and knock-on effects on political stability.
Have we found actual conflicts that are attributable to effects of climate change at this point?
It's a really difficult question to answer authoritatively about individual conflicts, because people like to talk about the Syrian civil war as being rooted in a drought, or the Darfur conflict in Sudan also being rooted in a drought. But there are also diverse causes and the role of the government, for example, in Syria and hastening the political repression that led to that civil war is also quite important. So it's a pretty tricky thing to unravel and identify both what kind of causal role it played and how important it was relative to other drivers. But it's something that the academic community is really attuned to trying to get a better handle on.
Yeah. Has it been an exacerbating factor in some of the conflicts, especially around the Horn of Africa?
Absolutely. I think people talk about climate risk as a threat multiplier that, you know, in concert with other causes makes a situation worse. I did another piece in Foreign Affairs in the fall looking at the combination of disruptions to agriculture, drought risk in countries that are highly dependent on agriculture and that have political institutions that are repressive. And so we developed a sort of watch list of here the countries that we think are at most risk of these kinds of destabilizing effects if there is a sort of drought in the middle of a growing season. And many of the countries that we identified as at risk were in that Sahel band in extending from West Africa over. And that's, many of those states are quite weak. A number of them have had civil wars in recent years. And so that coupled with persistent climate risks gives us cause for worry.
to ask about another issue, and that is analysts have been warning about wars over water. That was going to be the 21st century conflict point. Right. To my knowledge, there's not been any actual conflicts over water, a river war or a water war, although it has been a serious tension point between countries and in the pursuit of peace in certain troubled regions. I mean, the unspoken issue in the Middle East is water.
The interesting thing about water is that because it's central to human survival, that it often elicits cooperation, even albeit unequal water sharing, even in places like Israel and Palestine. The past may not be prologue. So we think about diminished water supplies along the Nile and increased competition. You know, Egypt for the longest time has taken the lion's share of that water. Now Ethiopia is in a position to build dams upstream. So they've struggled mightily to try and figure out a compromise so that Ethiopia can develop and use that water, but not fill that dam so fast that it diminishes the flow of water resources downstream to Egyptian farmers. That is a live issue and continues to this day. But there are other regions that are like that. Interestingly, you know, in places like India, which has a water-sharing agreement with Pakistan on the Indus dating back 40, 50 years. It's been quite successful that they've been able to share water despite having fought wars with each other. India internally has had trouble managing water on rivers like the Kaveri River, where there actually has been violence between communities over water sharing internally to that country. So there's sort of a myth of water wars between countries, but there's often conflict. Not always violent, but there's conflict we've seen in the U.S. between states over water sharing.
Or within a state, say between indigenous populations and developers in the Southwest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It happens all the time. Now, when you have adequate legal systems, most of those conflicts can be resolved through nonviolent means. Some countries are not as well equipped at being able to resolve disputes that way. And as these pressures from climate change get worse, it's going to be increasingly problematic to resolve water tensions both within countries and between countries.
You know, you talked about the Nile. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really the main dam is in Egypt at the, you know, the last country the waterway flows through before it goes in the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's kind of surprising to me that there hasn't been serious tensions on some of these major waterways that are life-sustaining for so many different countries, say, in Asia. In the Mekong is another river where when water supplies become tight, this could be a tension point down the road.
It's absolutely true. China's building a lot of dams upstream and downstream users and Vietnam and Cambodia and others have been affected, those effects have been worse when we've had recent droughts. And so the tensions between upstream and downstream users has become a kind of persistent feature dispute. Now, China's kind of a heavyweight, and it's a little unclear if downstream users have much recourse. But there are tens of millions of farmers in that part of the world that, if they can't continue their livelihoods, they're also people who fish on that river.
Fishermen and rice growers.
Yeah, they may have to do something different. There are going to be some complex bargains. You know, sometimes the upstream hydropower can generate electricity that they then can either provide at low cost to the downstream users to maybe compensate them for some of their losses, but that doesn't help the farmer out or the fisherman who's lost their livelihood. So these kinds of tensions are going to resurface and get worse in a world in which unpredictable, weird weather affects their livelihoods in significant ways.
We've seen the difficulty in getting all of the world's nations together on reducing CO2 emissions in a serious, meaningful way. Are there countries, though, that are bright spots as far as reducing their CO2 emissions and sort of leading the way?
Countries in Scandinavia are pretty progressive when it comes to climate policies on the whole. The UK, when it switched from coal to natural gas in the late 70s has diminished its emissions dramatically. Germany has also, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they closed on a lot of dirty industry in the East and has made heroic strides, although they made their job a little tougher by shutting down nuclear before turning their attention to coal. So there are a lot of countries, small countries in Scandinavia, who are making commitments to get their powering past coal is what they're calling this alliance of countries that are committed to shutting down their coal industries entirely. And UK and Canada are part of that, but there are a host of countries in Scandinavia that are also kind of leading the pack.
What strikes you as the most interesting mitigation technique that a nation's taking on? I know China's making some big investments in huge water flow movement from the south to the north. What strikes you as the most interesting there?
Well, I think electric vehicles is a really interesting technology. You think about what's happened in the U.S., emissions in the power sector have gone down, but transportation sector emissions continue to rise and rise and rise. But electric vehicles are poised for takeoff, and there are countries like Britain who've said, after 2025 or 2030, all new vehicle sales will have to be all electric. And there are a number of countries in Scandinavia that are pursuing that. And so there's a kind of electrification of everything concept that's out there, but starting with transport sector. And I think we're going to see that disruptive technology really, really taking off and providing an opportunity to address those emissions in the transport sector.
Right now, there's no movement on that front of the United States. We're actually moving back our fuel efficiency ratings at this particular point in the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. If we were to move in that direction, mm-hmm. this would be a massive change too, because, you know, right now, I don't know that we've done a lot to our electric grid in a number of years. I think a few years ago when there was a move towards more electric cars mm-hmm. and vehicles, they said, you know, we're going to need billions of dollars just to upgrade the electrical grid to be able to handle this increased electricity need for electric transportation.
Some of the changes in the electricity grid will have to happen, but probably more significant changes in infrastructure for charging stations. In the UK, you've had Shell and other major oil companies invest in the charging electricity system infrastructure, and I think that it's only 1% of car sales right now, and yet countries like China are seeing this as a new industrial opportunity for them to kind of win the clean economy war. And you know, they've cornered the market on solar panel exports, and you know, they're trying to do the same in the electric vehicle space. They've started a lot with procurement of bus fleets and rolling that out to a wider sector. So I think we obviously have the kind of green darling Tesla company, but probably more important is the major car companies to step forward and make a car. I have a Chevy Bolt, which is an all-electric vehicle that gets 240 miles before I have to charge it up again. And we need to see that coming from the major truck makers.
Joshua Busby was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. He is an associate professor of public affairs and a distinguished scholar at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas. He's also a senior research fellow at the Center for Climate and Security. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.